diplomacy is back at the center of our foreign policy.
My style in diplomacy is my style as a human being.
Diplomacy, John, the job of statesmen.
And I thought it was drinking and dancing.
Sue Boyd was a diplomat for 34 years. Among the few women allowed professional roles in the old Department of External Affairs that's morphed into the present-day Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. It's just lost its first female leader, Frances Adamson, to become Governor of South Australia, announced this week. Sue learned fairly early in her career the three central questions every diplomat, wherever they are in the world, needs to be able to answer and articulate well back to superiors in Canberra. What's going on? What's it mean for Australia? And what should we do about it? And the man who summarised it so succinctly was Prime Minister Gough Whitlam back in 1974 after the Portuguese Carnation Revolution. Sue had been on post throughout that convulsion, which ultimately led to huge changes in East Timor, and he wanted to know what this 25-year-old could tell him, having been up close and personal on Australia's behalf. She's distilled an eventful career into her book, Not Always Diplomatic, An Australian Woman's Journey Through International Affairs. And I spoke to her first about the need to answer those three central questions.
That's right. That's what we're all on about. That's what we're sent overseas to do. That's what every diplomatic mission is supposed to do. And that's been my mantra throughout my career.
And did you know that when you began? Like, who put the enthusiasm into you? And I wonder sort of how much you learned along the way.
No, I think I learned along the way. My first posting, I had to look around to find something useful to do, and I found that colonial policy was the thing which was interesting and of interest to Australia, so I got stuck into that. And that got me to do some useful work other than sitting around drinking wine and eating nice Portuguese food. So that gave me something useful to do on my first posting, which otherwise I have to say, and this is amazing to listen to now, I had a farewell interview with the then Secretary of the Department, and he told me Portugal was a wonderful post, lovely food, wonderful wine, great people, great architecture, great history, it would be lovely. And I said, well, Secretary, that's terrific, but what about the work? He said, work, don't you worry your pretty little head about that, would you believe? He said, no, this mission is set up as a sort of facilitation for an immigration program. So, no, you just go and enjoy yourself.
Oh, dear. I've been trying to scuttle the notion in this series that it is all about canapés and cocktails.
Well, exactly, exactly. But that's what he said. So I had to live it for myself and live the change reality and then embody that and pass it on to younger people who worked with me. And that's been the guiding principle, what Whitlam said. And in fact, when the Secretary of the Department, Frances Adamson, kindly launched my book in Canberra a couple of months ago, she said someone in the PMO, the Prime Minister's office, had said to her, this was such an essential mantra that it ought to be tattooed on the forehead of everybody who left Australia.
What's going on? What does it mean for Australia and what should we do about it?
What do we do about it? Exactly.
So what can it reasonably achieve as a discipline? What can't it achieve? I think both questions are important.
I think that's right. I think the thing about diplomacy, it is essentially human contact. It's one person working with another or working with a group of people. It's a give and take. It's a learning about other people's needs. It's about working out compromises to reach an objective which is acceptable to both sides in the negotiation. And that's done in human terms. The electronic stuff and all the other stuff sort of supplements all that and provides, if you like, a modern framework. But that essential history, that's the essential nature of what diplomacy is about, I think.
What had you done to prepare for it? In other words, what was your education, would you say, if you had to really distill it?
Well, I was very lucky. I was brought up internationally. My father was in the British Army. I was brought up in lots of overseas countries. I learned foreign languages from an early age. I learned to be resilient. I learned about other cultures. I learned that different is not inferior. And I learned to get on with other people. I went to 13 different schools in 8 different countries. So I had a wide international background, if you like, before I joined the Foreign Service.
Did you do anthropology, history, economics, that sort of thing?
No, I didn't. I had no idea that I was going to be a diplomat. That wasn't my plan, you know. That just sort of happened. No, I did arts. I did, first of all, languages, then I studied politics. So I majored in politics and English drama, and then I did a diploma of education on top of that.
I don't think I actually let you say what it can't achieve. What are its limits?
I'm not sure, frankly, that there are any limits when it's done properly. I think the limitations are set up by people using inappropriate means of trying to achieve their ends, and therefore setting up resistance elsewhere rather than facilitating conversations and facilitating exploration about what might be possible. So I think there's a danger in misusing the modern technology and, in fact, undermining traditional diplomacy.
I suppose what I'm maybe quietly asking is, do you see yourself as peacemaking? Is the aim to try to encourage a peaceful solution at all times or not?
Well, to the extent that you can, yes. But the bottom line is what your national interest is. And if you can get there by a way that facilitates what the other party wants as well, that's better than just doing your own thing and then having the people on the other side hostile to you and resistant to you and trying not to do what you want them to do. In my experience, you get an agreement between two parties where you've explored all the difficulties and all the possibilities and come to an agreement is more likely to be lasting, useful agreement than one that's imposed on another party.
You write in your book that you were in fear of your life, or it certainly becomes quite plain that you were during the Fiji coup crisis, which I think went on for 64 days, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, and you became utterly exhausted and you knew you couldn't go on. So this must be, well, what sort of memory is that? You were our representative, you were High Commissioner in Fiji.
And I realised that there were limits in what a person can do and your physical capacities and your mental capacities. And I recognised that I wasn't in a fit state then to make sensible decisions. And therefore, the most sensible decision at the time was to hand over and go and have a rest. So I did. I handed over to Margaret Toomey, my deputy, and I went off to a hotel not too far away where some of the Australian staff were, and I collapsed there really for 3 or 4 days. And then I felt fine. Then I could come back again and take over again. But I think there's a danger if you don't recognise those limitations that you can make the wrong decisions.
Gee, that's quite a thing to do. You weren't worried about concerns that you couldn't hack it?
Not really. I think I recognised that that was the sensible thing to do. You know, the alternative was to say, get me out of here, but that really wouldn't help. I mean, we were there to do a job and I wanted to do the job. And I had a very good staff who were all there and needing leadership and a big Australian community in the country that was looking to us for leadership. So we just had to do it and that was the way I managed to do it.
It was dangerous, wasn't it?
Well, they said so. We had threats against my life, but from a reliable source. I never got to the bottom of what that source was, but we sort of took it seriously at the time, and so we sent the staff home and did the things that we were supposed to do in those circumstances.
And what is your judgment on how Australia's national interest was served in that whole imbroglio?
Well, I think we were served very well indeed. What I managed to do with instructions from home and support was to negotiate with what had emerged to be an interim government and to persuade them that it was good to go to early elections and not to rest on their laurels and just continue to take the benefits of being in power. In our experience, interim governments, the longer they stay in government, the more comfortable they are and the less likely they are to actually call elections and move to democratic processes. And that's what we see happening in Fiji. So, and I encouraged them and we helped them and we gave them a lot of material support. In lots of little ways we helped. And I was the interface between the government and our government in all those negotiations.
What about when you disagree with the policy being pursued by your government and yet you are bound to advocate for it? Are you not?
That's right. And that is a difficult decision. I had that decision to make when the government imposed the Pacific solution on how to deal with asylum seekers.
This was in John Howard's time.
In John Howard's time. And I was instructed to go and ask them if any of them would help us by allowing us to set up a processing centre on their territory. And so I I hated the idea of doing that. I just thought this policy was wrong. I thought we're a rich and generous country. We've benefited from migration. You know, we have the capacity to absorb these asylum seekers who have come from horrendous situations. And for us to try and push this off to poor Pacific Island states, I thought was just outrageous. But this was what I was instructed to do by a government, which was a legitimate government, the Australian government, which had a legitimate mandate, and I had to do it. The alternative was to say, I'm not going to do this, I'm going to resign and leave it for somebody else. But that actually wouldn't have affected the situation. What would have happened is somebody else would have done it, and it would still have happened. And what I could do was, using my experience and my knowledge, to try and implement this policy in a way that did the least harm to Australia's interests. Mm. And so I discussed that with the staff, and we agreed that that's the path we should go down. And so that's the path we went down. I didn't like it, but I recognised that that was the best thing to do in the circumstances.
Let's sort of wind up with some of your experiences as a woman in DFAT, as it became DFAT, and many people have acknowledged, and you do yourself, how many people have told you that you were really quite a role model, because there were very few women in foreign affairs. In fact, your graduating class in 1970, there were two of you out of 23, and to your amazement, for doing exactly the same work, you discovered that you two were paid 10% less.
Yes, that's what it was then.
So how long did it take? How long did that take to be rectified?
Well, it took several years. I mean, government changed its position on women. The department changed its position. I was involved in the negotiating group, which worked out what the department had to do in order to achieve the objective, which was to have more women doing well in and getting through to more senior positions. We would get all right being taken in, but it was a question of getting up into more senior positions, going to embassies and so on. And that, or what happened when a couple were married, for example, what did you do about posting them? And what about women who were married and had children? And what did you have to do about facilitating their situation? So we negotiated all those, and I was involved in those negotiations. And so after years, and now, of course, there's a sort of almost equal number of women ambassadors to men ambassadors in the Australian Foreign Service. So after years, things changed. But it was a battle, and we had to keep pushing and have to sort of keep resisting efforts by people to denigrate us and undermine us and make life difficult for us. It was a constant battle.
And would you say that female representation and interpretation in cables is now taken as seriously as male?
I think so, yes. I think we're over the bump. I think now the situation in the department is very different from the situation that I was in.
And what
I
about other treatment of you by other countries where the position of women is even worse?
Well, I never found that in the countries I was posted to. I found the position of being High Commissioner gave me respect, right, or ambassador, and a country dealt with me appropriately when I was on overseas postings.
So that it was worse in Canberra.
It was worse in Canberra. But I'll tell you a quick story, though, about this. When I was at the United Nations, we were doing the disarmament work, and we were in a preparatory committee, which had an Indian ambassador as the chair, Ambassador Venkat. And every day at the close of business, he'd say, "Well, gentlemen, I think that completes our work for the day. I now close the session." So on the third day of that, I quickly took the floor and said, may I have the floor? Oh, yes, I give the floor to the charming delegate from Australia. I said, Mr. Chair, I said, we women on the committee are very tired. You have closed the session for the men for the last 3 days, but we women have been in constant session and we are very tired. Would you mind closing the session for us as well?" And he said, "Oh, I apologise to the most distinguished, most charming, most beautiful delegate of Australia, but when I was at school, my teacher taught us that man embraces woman unless otherwise specified." And I said, quick as a flash, "Ha-ha, but I bet he didn't tell you that gentlemen don't embrace ladies unless specifically invited."
Oh, very good. So Indian-Australian relations proceeded beautifully. Look, very, very final question. What's your favourite reading material? You know, what would you recommend, or something to watch that people might like to really understand this craft of yours better?
I think there is a terrific book that's been written just recently by an American who's the current Minister for International Development, Samantha Power.
Oh, yes.
She was ambassador to the UN.
For Barack Obama.
For Obama. And she's written a wonderful book called The Education of an Idealist, which I think covers very well all the grassroots stuff through to the high government stuff, the implementation and the development of policy, as well as the making of it. And I think it's a wonderful book to understand the whole process which we as diplomats are involved in.
Lovely. Well, Sue Boyd, thank you very much indeed for taking part in our series.
Pleasure to have been here. Thank you.
And Sue Boyd recently wrote about her life in Not Always Diplomatic. It's published by University of Western Australia Press.